Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. Here's your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Good afternoon. This is Bill O'Brien, and it is a pleasure to be with you again. I hope everyone's weekend was as pleasant as mine was. I had the privilege and honor of celebrating an anniversary yesterday, so good day, good weekend. I really had a wonderful weekend, and I look forward to a good week for our 3 days together, today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. I will tell you that we're still fooling with equipment, but we will get this right, I promise. Before we get into today's program a little bit, I wanted to mention a couple of things. One is the phone number. If anybody would like to call and engage in conversation, those of you who were listening the last time we got together, which was on Thursday, you may have heard a call from Betsy in Texas. We chatted for about 20 minutes, I guess, and one of the more delightful conversations I've had in a long, long time. I hope Betsy appreciated it nearly as much as I do, because I really, really enjoyed it. The number to call is area code 304-658-3333. Again, that's area code 304-658-3333. I wanted to mention on Saturday of this week, we conducted another of our chats in our PRISM West Virginia grant program from 3 to 5. And if you go to our PRISM website, which is PRISM, P-R-I-S-M-W-V .org, you can get the archived 2-hour presentation from our chat this past Saturday. I'm mentioning this specifically because over the course of the last 2.5 years, we've done a number of chats. My colleague Keith Lilly and I here, we did 3 or 4 the first year, which was 2010, 2011. They worked quite well. Very honestly, we thought that our teachers were getting a lot out of it. So in our 2011, 2012 year, we scheduled more of them. We were a little bit more ambitious. We scheduled 4 or 5 in our fall semester, and I believe 6 in our spring semester. So we had a total in the 2010-2011 academic year of about 10 chats. This year, in our 2011-2012, we're in 2012-2013 now. We have scheduled 7 this past fall, and this Saturday was, I believe, our 5th one, 4th or 5th, for this spring. So we've done it close to 30 chats over the last couple of 2.5 years or so. And I guess, like anything else, you could teach, you know, it's difficult to teach old dogs new tricks. But the fact of the matter is, even if I do say so myself, we're getting better at it each time. The reason I mentioned the PrismWestVirginia.org website and the archived copy of this past Saturday's chat is because I do believe it was one of our better ones. I thought the one previous to that, 2 weeks before that, was perhaps even was better than the ones that went before. But this past one, this Saturday, I thought was particularly helpful. It was on American foreign policy, and specifically, it was focusing on the foreign policy of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. The first hour, we spent pretty much almost exclusively on Theodore Roosevelt. And for those of you who teach, especially if you teach history, if you go to the archive of this particular chat, there is some wonderful, wonderful information in there. And I don't mean technical academic information. I mean personal information about T.R. and about the people he interacted with and perceptions of T.R. by those who knew him and worked with him and all the rest of it. And for all of this, I need to thank my colleague Keith Lilly, who is very, very much into T.R., and it was just a wonderful chat. It was rich in information and stories that you could use in your class to get to make TR a little bit more human, a little bit more personable, and a little bit more knowable for your students or for those who are just interested to know more about Theodore Roosevelt and about the whole issue of American foreign policy during his period. One of the things that I was trying to focus on during that chat was to focus on the ways in which Theodore Roosevelt, the consummate progressive, was progressive in his foreign policy as well, or to put it another way, in what ways was foreign policy during this progressive period progressive? And, of course, a lot of it depended on an appreciation and understanding of the whole concept of progressivism, the idea of paternalism, the idea of noblesse oblige, the idea that everybody is not equally qualified or equally capable to participate in foreign policy activities or decisions or policy development. And the way that Roosevelt was able to interact with his peers around the world, very, very famous. One of the best situations, I think, was when Roosevelt left the presidency in 2009, after the election of 2008, the election of Taft, to succeed him. And, of course, as we know, Roosevelt played a direct role, a very prominent role, in handing the baton, so to speak, to his selected follower, William Howard Taft. And, of course, Roosevelt, right after that, left the country on his famous safari to Africa, after which he traveled throughout the capitals of Europe. And Keith Lilly had tremendous stories about the reception that he received in foreign countries and the extent to which many of the leaders in Prussia, in France, in Great Britain really believed that even though Roosevelt had left the presidency, he would be back as president. They really believed that they were dealing with the president of the United States when they were dealing with TR. Made it very, very difficult politically for Taft, who actually was the president during the time, during this particular time. The point I'm trying to make, it was a very, very rich, informative, very human, personable kind of session, and I think you will find the information in it quite enlightening and quite helpful. The second hour of the chat, we focused more on the change from Woodrow Wilson. We went from the personable to the non-personable, if you will. Wilson had a very difficult time dealing with the public and interacting with people. Even though, I mean, we were cognizant of the fact and mentioned the fact that those who knew Wilson best on a very personal basis attested to the fact that Wilson, on a personal one-on-one basis, was very warm and very personable and very easy to talk to and relate to. But as president and as one addressing Congress, or as one addressing the American people, or as one involved in diplomacy, especially when he went to Europe at the end of World War I at Versailles to negotiate the peace treaty ending the war, Wilson found it very, very difficult to get along with Clemenceau and Lloyd George and the other leaders of the victorious Allies. And so the transition from Roosevelt to Wilson was a very dramatic one. And, of course, then we focused primarily on Wilson's 14-point program and the game plan that he had for the future of the world. I think, personally, and this is me, I kind of maybe hogged the mic a little bit during the Woodrow Wilson thing because I feel a little bit more comfortable with Wilson than I do with Roosevelt. And besides the fact, when you have Keith Lilly there and you want to talk about Theodore Roosevelt, there's just nobody that's better able to do that than Keith. But in our discussion of Wilson's 14-point program, one of the things that I see as particularly significant is that if you look at the totality of Wilson's program, it's kind of a plan for organizing and managing the world in such a way that World War I would indeed be the war to end all wars. Wilson, of course, famously made that statement that he hoped that he thought that World War I would be the war to end all wars, and his reason for that was the 14 points, especially number 14, which was the creation of a League of Nations to manage the world. And one of the things I find is very significant is that what Wilson is effectively doing is transposing America's federal political system in terms of the relationship between the states and the federal government to the world level with the creation of the League and the individual countries that belong to the League. In other words, Wilson is an expert on political structure, on political science. He's a political scientist. And he wrote a multi-volume, an excellent study on the British political system, which he admired very, very much. But his belief at Versailles that you could have the League of Nations play on an international basis the same role that the federal government plays within the United States domestically, and that each country within the League would operate on the same from the same game plan or the same page, if you will, as the states within the Union, you can begin to see Wilson's commitment to this idea of system and his fixation with management and his idea that if you set up the proper system and you manage it properly, then you indeed can manage the world in such a way that you can prevent war from ever happening again. Brilliant, brilliant story on the part of Wilson. Of course, it didn't work for a lot of reasons, one of which that the United States did not get into the League. But we're off our game plan a little bit in terms of the Constitution, but not really. I think we'll end up in these kinds of things anyway. But I just wanted to take the first 10 or 15 minutes of today's program and really encourage you, if you have an extra hour or two, to go to your online, just go to prismwv.org and click on to the archive of yesterday's chat session. In our program, I think you will be you will find it time well spent. Last time we were together here on our virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, we were looking at the nature of Republican government and the whole issue of republicanism as it surfaced around ratification of the Constitution. Last week, if you remember, we were focusing on debates between Federalists and Anti-Federalists over the nature of republicanism. And more specifically, what we were looking for, what I was looking for, was an appreciation of the changes between changes in the nature of republicanism once the Constitution of the United States is ratified, once the new federal union is created and the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation, is replaced by the new Constitution. The Federalists made it a point, dramatically emphasized the fact that we were still retaining or maintaining the nature of Republican government, even though we were changing the nature of the Union in the Articles. While we were strengthening the central government, we were doing so in a way which would not jeopardize or would not alter or sacrifice America's commitment to republicanism. And I remember we looked at a quote in the Philadelphia, in the Pennsylvania ratifying convention by James Wilson, in which James Wilson pointed out that the new Constitution is the best of both worlds. It creates a government with the kind of power that government needs in order to do what government has to do in today's international world. But at the same time, it did so while preserving the key ingredients of popular government and republicanism that all Americans were committed to. And if you remember, we looked especially at one Brutus anti-federalist paper, which was a major criticism of the new Constitution, urging states to vote against it on the argument that in the process of ratifying this new system, the nature of republican government as defined by and as Americans were committed to according to the ideas of Montesquieu in his Spirit of the Laws would be lost. That Brutus made very, very clear that what the Constitution did was create the kind of a large, pluralistic, quite diverse union which would make the nature of republicanism as defined and advocated by Montesquieu impossible. Montesquieu's argument was, and the Anti-Federalist campaign focused around the fact that republican government must be in a small, confined area. A republic must, by definition, be small, because in order for republicanism to work, the elected representative must know the wants and needs of the constituents within the republic that that particular representative represents. And the fact of the matter is, if you make the republic too large, and you make it too diverse, and you create a number of different and competing interest groups, or factions, if you will, Madison's term is factions, within the republic, you create a situation where the competing nature of factions makes it impossible, because of the large size, for the representative to know the needs and wants of the different groups. The result is that the representative is making the decision in behalf of constituents without knowing what he needs to know in order to make that decision wisely. The point that I was trying to make at the end of this story was that that criticism of the Constitution and the effect that it would have on republicanism is more than just happenstance. I would argue that that transition of power from constituents to the representative that they elect is not just an accidental outcome of the larger republic. It is, in fact, what drives it. I would argue that the Federalists, in a very duplicitous way, were altering, consciously altering the nature of republican government in such a way that they would effectively transfer the power of decision-making from constituents to the elected representatives of those constituents. By creating large, diverse, pluralistic republics or congressional districts, you were taking in so many competing factions and interest groups that you made it unlikely that there would be a majority faction, that one group would be so overwhelming over all the others that it could get the representative's ear and force the representative to act accordingly. Rather, what you would have would be a series of minority factions competing with each other for to be heard. The result would be that the representative himself would make the decision and basically could justify that decision by claiming that his view of the entire republic, with all the competing factions within it, made it, from his particular vantage point, the best decision under the circumstances. So the result is that power is shifted from constituents to elected representative. This is very consistent with the definition of representative put forth in the 1770s by Edmund Burke in Great Britain, who argued that the role of the representative in a republic is to listen to and be aware of the needs and wants of constituents, but that the representative must be the one who makes the ultimate decision, never the constituents. And in effect, what ratification of the Constitution in the United States did was bring that effect into being. That was the result. So in effect, the ratification controversy over the Constitution was in part not only a political struggle, a very interesting political struggle if you get into the different states, and we'll do that in the course of future programs, but it's also duplicitous, because it is also suggesting to people that the degree of change in their day-to-day lives is going to be less than the Federalists really know that it's going to be. In a sense, the people believe in ratifying the Constitution or in voting for Federalists to represent them in the ratifying conventions. The people believe that they are voting for one thing, when in effect they are voting for something quite different. It's very clear that the people are not being given the kinds of honest, upfront, complete information that they need in order to make intelligent decisions as citizens, which kind of flies in the face of the whole idea put forth by Jefferson, Madison, the others, that the people are the best defenders or protectors of their own rights, not government, and that the best way to keep government on the straight and narrow is within alert, intelligent citizenry. And yet what we find is the Constitution itself is ratified in a way which quite contradicts that bromide, if you will. I use the term bromide not by accident, because I think it's very, very important. I think it's very, very real and very important. One of the other things that we looked at in our last time together was one of the most profound, interesting, and I think significant letters in all of this period, a letter from Otto, the French charge d'affaires in New York, back to his supervisor in France, the Comte de Vergennes, who is the French foreign minister. And that letter, for a number of reasons, is very significant. It suggests what I just implied. That letter basically lays out in spades the fact that the people really are not quite aware of what it is they're voting for. They're being told that they're voting for one thing when in fact they're voting for something quite different. Otto is writing immediately after the adjournment of the Annapolis Convention in October of 1787. And, excuse me, 1788. And, no, again, I'm wrong on my dates. 1786, we're talking before the Constitution, the Annapolis Convention in September and early October of 1786. So Otto's letter is dated October 1786. And in that letter, Otto basically suggests that the official report that came out of the Annapolis Convention explaining the call for the convention in Philadelphia the next May, which is going to be the Constitutional Convention, that the people really were kind of buffalo. They were kind of schmoozed in that letter.
Dr. Bill?
Yes, Bob.
Sorry to interrupt, but if you don't mind, we will reconnect and reestablish a good quality connection.
Thanks.
Stand by, please.
Thanks, Bob.
We will be back momentarily to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Dr. Bill O'Brien. Dr. Bill, are you there?
This is Bill O'Brien back with you. Are we in good shape, Bob?
Great shape.
Okay. And we were talking about the Otto letter, and I wanted to kind of reiterate some of the things we talked about yesterday. And basically what Otto reports to his supervisor, Vergennes, in France, that he tells him that he has taken care not only to put the report into French for Vergennes, but also to render it intelligible. And then he goes on to explain that those who wrote that report on the Annapolis Convention, and this is a quote, endeavored to give the original an obscurity that the people will see through with difficulty, but which the powerful and enlightened citizens will not fail to turn to account. Effectively, then, what Otto is reporting back to Vergennes is that the story that the people are getting about the Annapolis Convention is not the real story at all.
Dr. Bill, we need to reconnect.
Okay, Bob.
Just remember, not the real story at all. Be right back. Stand by, please. And I believe we have you back, Dr. Bill.
I think we're back. Okay, thank you, Bob. And so basically the story that the people are being given is not the real story at all, as in effect – the report is being written in such a way. I don't know quite how to explain this. I'll try. Over the years, I've tried to explain this in a number of different ways. I've even gone so far as to tell classes that a lot of these documents, these official documents, are almost written in code. And what I mean they are written in a way which the people that need to understand what they say can understand very well, because they are alerted, they know exactly what to look for. But the general population, which is not educated to read at this level, it's almost like the fine print on a credit card, if you've ever read that, the terms of the agreement when you enter into debt. It's written by attorneys for attorneys, and the average person can't understand it. I think we talked about this last week. The fact of the matter is many of these documents are written the same way. And the only way to understand, the information is there, but you almost have to dig it out with a shovel. And the reason it's so difficult for most people, students, is that we are not taught to read that way. We are not taught to read critically. The result is that the people are getting one, you know, are reading what they think is one thing, whereas in effect they're getting something quite different that they really don't understand. If you read the Federalist Papers, for example, and I've done this with students all the time, and the reason I'm doing this is because I want to kind of lay this out before we get into some of these documents. We'll be into the Federalist Papers. In fact, I've always had a dream that if we ever had a program like this, one of the things I would like to do literally is walk us through the Federalist Papers. Most people never read them. They say they know them. They're familiar with them. They know what they are. But it's kind of like Uncle Tom's Cabin. Everybody knows what it is, so nobody has to bother reading it. Whereas, in effect, if you read these Federalist Papers, you come to the very specifics of the issues and the items that the courts focus on, that the Supreme Court focuses on in interpreting the Constitution, the nuances of language and all this. These documents are written by attorneys, and the average person not only can't understand them, but very honestly isn't expected to, and the fact of the matter is many of these people don't want the people to be able to understand a lot of these things. And what Otto's letter to Vergennes does is lay that reality out in spades. He makes very clear to Vergennes that this document, this official report of the Annapolis Convention, is being written in a way that the people cannot understand. They think they're reading one thing when in fact they're reading something else. And he goes on and clarifies this and says, basically, the people are not unaware that the natural consequences of giving more power to government, I kind of put that in there because he takes a lot longer to explain it. But he says the people are not unaware, the people realize that the results of a government that has power and can really operate effectively, the result for them is going to be the regular collecting of taxes, a strict administration of justice, extraordinary duties on imports, strict actions against debtors, and lastly, a marked preponderance of the rich and the very and the great proprietors. So, in a sense, the people know this. It is, Otto says, in these tempestuous times that it was necessary to agree that all power should emanate only from the people, that everything be submitted to its supreme will, to the people's will, and that the magistrates be only its servants. So Otto is saying something very, very important here. He is telling Vergennes that when people realized, when the people who are making the decisions realize that the people will never go for a government which can more effectively collect taxes, force debtors to pay their debts, collect duties on imports, and give a proper authority and influence to the wealthy and to great proprietors, the people are never going to buy that. They know that. So what Otto says is the only option they had is to begin the process which still goes on in our schools, in government classes and civic education classes and all the rest of it, to tell the people that while there are changes going on in government, the thing that has not changed is that all power emanates from the people, that everything done will be submitted to the people for their approval, and that magistrates will remain the servants of the people. So in a sense, the litany of beliefs that the American people are given in order to relax them and make them more likely to endorse the kind of change which is going to make government more effective, the people have to be made to believe that they are still in control. And so they are told that, even though the reality we just talked about in terms of the shift in Republican government, the shift in power from the constituents to the representative, is an effective part of this. In other words, those in positions of power know exactly what they are talking about. I tried to lay my hands on this letter, and I haven't been able to do it. But several years ago, I found a letter, and at the time, it seemed important to me. I have revisited the concept several times, but I've never been able to lay my hands on the letter again. I can't remember exactly when or where the letter was from, but it was James Madison, and he was getting letters during the ratification controversy over the Constitution. He was getting communiques, letters, from Federalists in various states who were having difficulty selling the Constitution. And, of course, there was the Anti-Federalists had tremendous influence, tremendous power. There was a distinct possibility in many states that the Constitution would not be ratified. It was a toss-up. It was a 50-50 proposition as to whether the people would buy this. So the campaign had to be rigorous. It had to be intense. And so the Federalists from different states are constantly communicating with each other on strategies that work and strategies that don't work. And one of the letters that Madison receives, and I can't remember from whom, I keep thinking it's from Rufus King, but I'm not sure of that. But anyway, the letter basically states, we're having an awful lot of trouble here. This is Massachusetts. We're having an awful lot of trouble convincing people that the Constitution is safe, because every time we talk about the checks and balances system and the right of the president to veto laws and the right of the Senate to vote against laws passed in the House of Representatives and the ability of the Supreme Court to strike down in other words, the checks and balances system, which gives us all a sense of safety and reliance and stability. He writes Madison and said, I'm having trouble because they keep going back to the total power of the new federal government, the total power that we'll have over the states as compared to the Confederation period. And he said to Madison, we're having trouble countering that argument. And Madison's response is one of the most telling letters that I've ever seen. And Madison says, you never allow the conversation to revolve around the total power of the central government vis-a-vis the states. What you always do is emphasize the internal checks and balances built into the system so that people will feel secure that while the federal government appears power, in effect, it can't exercise it because of the safety checks that we've built into the system. And Madison said, basically, you never talk about the totality of power from the national level. In effect, what Madison is saying is, you concentrate, during the ratification struggle, you concentrate people's attention on the trees. You never let them look at the total forest. And Madison's position is, the only way you can get people to buy into the system is if they don't really appreciate the tremendous change that this system promises. So in a sense, there's an element of duplicity here. There's an element of insincerity here. We're talking about a political struggle for the very survival of this nation. And these people believe, the Madisons and the Washingtons and the John Jays and the Hamiltons and the rest of them, they really believe that if this Constitution isn't ratified, we will not make it as a nation. In fact, Benjamin Franklin says that in his closing address to the Constitutional Convention on the 17th of September, 1787, as old as he is, he said basically every one of us would change something in this Constitution. Every one of us wishes one or more parts of it were different. But the fact of the matter is, he said, we've been here since May. We've been here through the heat of the summer. We have argued, we have fought, we have negotiated, we have compromised. What we have come out with is the best that sincere, serious people can do. The last thing we can afford to have is for this system to be defeated and to bring us back into session again. This is the best we're ever going to get. He said there's an amendment process. If parts of it don't work, we can fix it. But Franklin makes the point. You've got to go back to your states, and you have to make the case that it's this government or anarchy. There is nothing in between. It is either this or chaos. It is either this and the end of independence as a nation. And once people are made aware of what the choices are, they will ratify, especially if they are reassured that the amendment process makes it possible to fix parts of it that don't work in the future. But the most important thing, Franklin says, is to get this thing through. And that's what the Federalists do, and the stories of how they do it in state after state are wonderful, wonderful stories. And I think all of us can appreciate this. So, in effect, what Otto is saying is something that many experts on this period know, but it's very, very difficult to say that to the general population, because the general population is not prepared to hear that when you talk about the founders, the fact that the founders or the framers of the Constitution were duplicitous or insincere or were playing politics or whatever pejorative term that you want to assign to them. The fact of the matter is, in a political world as existed in late 18th century America, Franklin laid it out. You got to get this. Whatever you need to do, you got to get this system through. We've been struggling for 4 months. This is the best we can come up with. Let's put wheels under this sucker and get it underway, and we can fix it later, is what Franklin urges the delegates to do as they disband and go back to their states. So, in a sense, and I'm reading from a text that I wrote here, but it kind of brings this to a conclusion. Otto's message then is that the people thought they were voting for one thing by buying into the suggested political change suggested at the Annapolis Convention. They were opting for something quite different. Because the people knew what to expect from a government that would be efficient and effective, and they wouldn't like it. The only way to sell the change was to assure the people that they were always in control, that those they elected would always be their servants. The official documents, those released for public consumption, Otto reported, were written in language that the people would have a hard time understanding. And this is a repeat. This is the quote from Otto's letter. An obscurity that the people will see through with difficulty. But these would be written in language that the powerful and enlightened citizens would understand perfectly. The way I see this is my interpretation, what we are confronting here is political duplicity in the first degree. A premeditated, carefully calculated relationship between representative and voter that is driven principally by an uninformed, if not ill-informed, electorate, content to leave the most meaningful decisions to those they elect. But the problem is potentially even worse, and this is where I want it to go today and perhaps tomorrow in our program. But the problem is potentially even worse, because it raises the very real, distressing likelihood of two different systems of education at play in America. One for the leaders, and a very different, less rigorous one for everyone else. Something quite akin to separate but equal. A system of separate but equal based on class rather than based on race. The one we're familiar with, of course, is the race issue in the South of separate school systems and transportation systems and restrooms and all the rest of it. The separate but equal ruling of the Supreme Court in the 1890s and 1896 in Plessy versus Ferguson that endorsed the idea of separate but equal. I would suggest that what I'm suggesting here is that what we're seeing in this ratification struggle is the possibility, is the likelihood that what we are looking here are two different systems of education. One's for the citizens in a republic, the other for the leaders who will make the decisions. And the process is somehow we have to educate the followers to follow the lead of the leaders. And that seems to be the game plan that really pretty much gives rise to our education system in America. At least it is the way I understand it, and it bothers me immensely. How else to explain it, I've said. To those eager to dismiss Otto as a confused foreigner, a stranger to our shores who really is unable to grasp the nuances of American republicanism, one must consider the visit some years later by another Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville. I think we mentioned this the other day. He was really a visitor, where Otto was a minister, paid to grasp and report real news from New York City, the hub of American politics. So in a sense, it seems to me what we're almost forced to deal with here is the nature of our education system, because if we are talking about an educated citizenry, and if the nature of American republicanism and the nature of participatory government in America relies on the nature of on the existence of an educated citizenry, then we have to look into the nature of that education in order to make sense out of the whole thing. You'll remember last week that I had shared with you another famous statement from James Madison when he talked about the nature of the educated citizenry. And this was many years after he left the presidency in 1822. James Madison, in a letter to a friend, said the following: "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps to both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives." It seems to me that what we need to do is look at that statement and then look at the education system that the founders believed we needed in America, and try to arrive at an understanding as to what these people really believed and what they meant when they talked about the nature of an educated citizenry. As an educator, one who's been in the classroom for close to a half a century, this particular subject, to me, is probably the most important one, personally and professionally and emotionally, that I could engage and entertain in a program like this. I think that this issue, today and tomorrow and perhaps Wednesday, however long it takes, and again, I remind you of the phone number, area code 304-658-3333. I would love to hear from you on this. This is one of the most important issues that I think we will ever confront in order to understand the nature of America's political process and the idea, the intent of the founders, and all the rest of it. It revolves around the nature of education. These people were well educated. They were attorneys. They came from homes with parents who were ministers. They were merchants. They were businessmen. They were prominent people, many of whom had traveled extensively throughout Europe. They knew what the nature of international relations was all about. They knew what a nation needed in order to gain respect, and they knew that under the Confederation, America was not going to gain the kind of respect that it needed, not when it was unclear whether power resided with each individual state or whether power resided at the national level in the person of the Continental Congress. And the numbers of foreign ambassadors who facetiously made the comment that they didn't know whether they were dealing with one American government or 14 different ones, 13 state governments plus the national government. So it was very clear to these people that there had to be a change. They had to make a change. Part of that change, very honestly, is political, but part of it is social as well. We are talking about the realities of class-based politics and a class-based society. We are talking about an age in the late 18th century when people did not believe that everybody was equal. People believed that those who were destined for positions of power and influence and policymaking in society needed to be educated in a way that equipped them properly for the role that they were to play. And they believed that everybody was neither capable nor that everybody was not capable to fill that role. Clearly, the people who were educated to lead had to be able to lead. All of the stuff about that Jefferson wrote in the Declaration about we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that government derives its just power from the consent of the governed. The idea that the majority of the people call the shots in our society was absolutely counterproductive and basically absurd to these people. If you allowed the majority to call the shots, to make the decisions, the major policy decisions for the new nation, you were, in effect, allowing the least qualified people to make them, because everybody knew throughout history that talent and ability was in the person of the few, not the many. In any society where you distinguish between the few and the many, as Alexander Hamilton said, the few are the rich and well-born. The many's everybody else. Somehow, whatever kind of political system you have to create one in which the right people make decisions. It's not that you don't allow the masses to participate in the process, but you do not allow them to make the decisions. That's really the basis for the transition in republicanism that we talked about earlier. That's why the large republic works for the Federalists under the Constitution, whereas the small republic would not. In the Confederation period, where the states were dominant, you had the smaller republics that where it was much easier for constituents to get control and issue orders, instructions to their elected representatives. Madison and the founders, the framers of the Constitution, believed that this could not work. You had to basically change that particular system. So it seems to me we're kind of at a place where the next step in our program is pretty well laid out ahead of us. We have to look at the nature of education in American society. And I know that there are a number of people out there listening to this who probably have a lot to say and a lot of input. Many of you are teachers. Many of you teach on the higher education level. Many of you are parents. You went through school as students. You know what school's like. You have children in school. They come home and tell you what's going on. You know what school. Well, you know what the educational process is like. Ironically, it's the one thing in our society that we all seem to have in common. We've all been students. Many of us have reared students as parents, and the one thing we know better than anything else is the education system, because we've all been through it. We may be different religions. We may be different nationalities. We may have different backgrounds. We may have different, come from different places in society. But the one thing we have in common is that we've all been students. And the one thing we all know is it doesn't matter whether you're a student in a classroom in Florida or the state of Washington, whether you're a student in Southern California or in Maine, whether you're a student in Iowa or Chicago, New York City, or Des Moines, Iowa. The one thing that we know for sure is that wherever you go, if your parents move or you move into a new school district anywhere in the nation, in the first day of school, you will be comfortable, because there will be nothing that you are not familiar with. The one thing we have in common in our history is that our schools have tended to operate from the same script. They are set up the same way. For years and years and years, our schools functioned around the idea that desks were lined up in rows, Students were not allowed to wander, let their eyes wander right or left. They were not allowed to look at each other's paper because cooperation in learning was cheating. They were reared to respond to bells. And, of course, many people see this as a figment of the industrial age where many of these people were going to end up working in factories anyway. So the school system functioned around clocks and bells. Students knew that classes ended when a bell rang. They knew that the next class began when a bell rang. They knew that they were required to be certain places at certain times and be doing certain things. One of the things that I always talk about in class, because I think it's kind of ironic, my first teaching experience was in the city of Boston. I taught in the inner city in what then was called a junior high school. Now it's called a middle school in Boston. It was not in the South. It was in the city of Boston. But it was extremely, extremely segregated. The middle school, the junior high school that I taught in, the Mary E. Curley School in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, had about 1,200 students in it. And you could count the number of Caucasians on one hand. 99% of the student body in that school was African American, was black. Yet, with one or two exceptions, every administrator and every instructor was Caucasian, was white. I went my first teaching experience there, and one of the things I had to get used to was the routine, was the schedule, because everything was on schedule. And I used to marvel at the fact that between the second period and the third period, every day, there was a bathroom period. That was the time when students were to leave their classrooms, leave their classrooms and go to the restroom. And it used to amaze me to think that in a city the size of Boston, with as many junior high schools or middle schools as Boston had, that every eighth grader in the city of Boston was being asked to pee at the same time. That amazed me, because that in effect is system. And if you raise youngsters in that kind of a setting, in that kind of a system, which functions with bells and silence and honesty and keeping your eyes front and not talking and remaining silent and not passing papers around and not interacting with your classmates and all the rest of it, then we have made changes, absolutely no question. But the fact of the matter is many of us were raised in that kind of a system. And if you relocate from the city of Boston to Los Angeles, it doesn't make any difference. You'd be comfortable on the first day of school. You watch television programs where you see high schools or middle schools where they're changing classes, and you're very comfortable with it because they all function the same way. The system was rigid, it was rigorous, and it was inflexible. And the result was that's the way most of our young people received their formal education. And so therefore, what the founders intended, what they hoped for, and what American education was designed to produce is a critical part in our effort to understand the nature of the United States Constitution and the implications and nuances of that system as it affects the people who live under it and who respect it. We have reached the top of our first hour together today. Let's take a break for 4 or 5 minutes and listen to some music, and then we'll be back and we'll begin to look at the educational system, and we're going to go to the good American education, Mr. Jefferson.
We now return to Dr. Bill O'Brien and the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution.
This is Bill O'Brien back with you for the
And we need to reconnect, Bill. I'm sorry. Somehow or another, the signal degraded during that time, so we'll be right back to you.
Okay, bye. I believe we're back.
We are indeed.
We were at the point of Thomas Jefferson into this discussion about education, and I don't think we could begin it at a better place. Jefferson is considered to be the godfather of American universal education. Many of you know, if you study history of American education, you know that the origins of the public school movement and the idea that everybody in the community needed to be educated goes all the way back to the Puritans in Massachusetts, the idea being that the need to read and listen to the sermons and understand Scripture basically made it absolutely vital that every citizen be literate. Jefferson picked this up in Virginia and began to put together a plan for universal education. It becomes the model, and it becomes a model that is pretty well adopted. Jefferson, in the 1770s, introduces his plan, which is called a bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge. And basically, it is a proposal that would absolutely guarantee everybody a basic education. And this plan is enacted in Virginia in the late 70s, I believe. And in Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, and I find this even more significant than reading the legislation itself, in Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, Jefferson lays out exactly what his bill is intended to do, what is intended to accomplish, and why it is so necessary in a republic which has just become independent from the mother country. And so this is Jefferson's bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge. And very simply, I want to explain the proposal that he had and read you a couple of statements from Jefferson's pen, and then we can basically proceed from there. According to Jefferson, the entire state of Virginia would be divided into school districts, which he called hundreds. And in the hundreds, every person, this is a quote directly, every person in it would be entitled to send their children to school 3 years gratis. In other words, at no cost. If they were willing or had the resources to pay, they could continue their child longer. But everybody was entitled to 3 years of basic education, basic literacy education, if you will. These schools, according to Jefferson, each school was to be under a visitor who annually was to choose the boy of best genius in his school. Now, first thing to note, of course, we're talking about boy of best genius, of most genius. We are not talking about girls. Girls do not get formal education during this period. It's only boys. So basically, the visitor at each school is to choose annually the boy of best genius in that school. And if the boy of best genius came from a family where the parents were too poor to send them on to one of the 20 grammar schools to be spread around Virginia, then the state of Virginia would pick up the cost. But the brightest student in each school would be able to continue his education, either at his own expense or at public expense. And this is what Jefferson says, which I think is pretty powerful. By this means, Jefferson said, 20 of the best geniuses will be raked from the rubbish annually and be instructed at the public expense. I've had debates over the years with students because most students can't believe that the best geniuses would be raked from the rubbish annually. Because I make the students aware that if we're talking about picking the brightest student out of our class, then the rest of us, Jefferson is defining as rubbish. And I've had students say, well, maybe rubbish didn't mean the same thing in 1770s as it means today, and on and on and on. But the fact of the matter is, that's what Jefferson said. By this means, 20 of the best geniuses will be raked from the rubbish annually and be instructed at public expense. And then he goes on, in Greek, Latin, geography, and the higher branches of arithmetic. 10 of the 20, chosen for the superiority of their parts and disposition. In other words, of the 20 selected, the 20 genius selected, 10 of the best, the 10 best of those who will be chosen for the superiority of their parts and disposition will be moved on to William and Mary. Jefferson explained, the other half to be dismissed. And then he says something really profound. From among whom the grammar schools will probably be supplied with future masters. So what Jefferson is talking about here is a merit system in education. But a system where every child was guaranteed at least 3 years of schooling. And then the brightest ones would continue beyond that, all the way to William and Mary, if their abilities took them that far. But I find it interesting that the masters of our grammar schools, our teachers, do not come from the 10 selected to go to William and Mary. They come from the 10 who are dismissed. In other words, one of the most interesting parts of Jefferson's program here is that the teachers of the children do not come from the brightest students. They come from good students, but not the greatest students. And so the question, it seems to me a question that has to linger in the back of our minds. Why does Jefferson not want the brightest people to be in our classrooms? Why does he want intelligent people, literate people, but not the brightest people? Now, you may be, in your mind, you may be figuring all sorts of answers to that question. And some of them may be creative, and some of them may be insightful, and some of them may be not nice. But the fact of the matter is, Jefferson believed that the brightest, the ones that go on to William and Mary, are not the ones that end up teaching in our schools. The ones that end up teaching in our schools are the 10 of the 20, once you make the cut. Jefferson is talking clearly about what we call student-centered education here. Education that is based on a student's ability. In other words, only the brightest go on. Everybody gets the foundation. But from there on, it's a competitive struggle to see who goes on and who doesn't. And the state is willing to pay for it. And Jefferson, in his notes on the state of Virginia, explains exactly what his program is all about. And this is a quote from Thomas Jefferson. The general objects of this law are to provide an education adapted to the years, to the capacity, and the condition of everyone, and directed to their freedom and happiness. Let me stop there for a second. What Jefferson is talking about is tailoring the nature of education to the age, abilities, and the conditions of students. It is student-centered education in the sense that the level and the rigor of education is tied directly to who the kid is and to what his abilities are. Because the purpose, as Jefferson said, is directed to their freedom and their happiness. He's not looking to put students into an educational situation which is going to frustrate them or make them feel unhappy or bad or anything else. He basically wants the student to be successful. But in order to do that, you have to basically tailor the education to the particular student or link up the student with the level of education. Bottom line, every student is not getting the same education. Every student is not getting an equal opportunity, if you were, except in the selection process for the Boys of Best Genius. Every year you pick the brightest one and pull them, you know, you cherry pick them and you send them on to the next level. And everybody else is dismissed at that point unless they come from homes, come from a background that has the resources to continue their education at their own expense rather than public expense. Jefferson goes on. The first stage of this education, this is the 3 years and the hundreds that everybody goes to. The first stage of this education being the schools of the hundreds, wherein the great mass of the people will receive their instruction, the principal foundations of future order will be laid here. What Jefferson is saying is that the principal purpose of 3 years of required education for everybody, from the state's point of view, is safety and security and order. This has it has nothing to do with building skills or encouraging free thinking or encouraging analytical thinking or questioning or anything else. It is about order. It is about stability. It is about society's safety and security. It is about creating the kind of unity within the state that everybody needs. Jefferson goes on. The first elements of morality, too, may be instilled into their minds. Notice, morality does not exist within the students. Morality exists outside and has to be instilled in their minds, brought in and fed to them. Disseminated upon them, whatever verb or whatever word you want to use. Such as, and he gives examples, may teach them how to work out their own greater happiness by showing them that it does not depend on the condition of life in which chance has placed them, but is always the result of good conscience, good health, occupation, and freedom in all just pursuits. Jefferson's position is that the basic elements of morality are instilled in their minds during this first 3 years when everybody is in school. And the goals of this specifically are to teach them that their happiness does not depend on their condition of life. It doesn't depend on how poor you are, how poor your parents are, or everything else. So what they are being taught is to accept their role, whatever that happens to be, accept their place, by suggesting that the condition of their life is relatively unimportant in which chance has placed them. In other words, it's just the luck of the draw that you happen to be born into a family which is poor and has to work hard and everything else. But that's not really the most important thing. You can be happy within that. And that's one of the jobs of education, is to make sure that you are, but also is the result of good conscience, good health, occupation, in other words, you got to work for a living, and freedom in all just pursuits. We all have a basic education. We all have freedom. We all have access and opportunity. If we have good health and a clear conscience, and we're good people, and we do what we're told, and we respect authority, and all the rest of it, we'll be fine. As Jefferson said. Jefferson left little doubt as to what the purpose of this entire program's intent is. He says, here's exactly what he says. But of all the views of this law, none is more important, none more legitimate, than that of rendering the people safe, as they are the ultimate guardians of their own liberty. For this purpose, reading in the first stage, where they will receive their whole education, is proposed to be chiefly historical. I got to read that again. Jefferson says, of all the views of this law, none is more important, none is more legitimate than that of rendering the people safe, as they are the ultimate guardians of their own liberty. For this purpose, the reading in the first stage, where they will receive their whole education, is proposed to be chiefly historical. What this means is the teaching of history is to be the basis of curriculum during this first 3 years. Because this is where the student's education in what being a citizen in a republic is going. This is where the student is going to learn what a citizen's responsibilities are in a republic during this years, during this these first 3 years. And the way you do it is by making the curriculum predominantly history. Jefferson goes on and explains that. And he said history, by apprising them of the past, will enable them to judge of the future. It will avail them of the experience of other times and other nations. It will qualify them as judges of the actions and designs of men. It will enable them to know ambition under every disguise it may assume, and knowing it, to defeat its views. Every government degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. The people themselves, therefore, are its only safe depositories. And to render even them safe, their minds must be improved to a certain degree. Wow. Wow. The reason that people must study history is because it not only makes them aware of the past so that they'll be able to judge the future, but it also avails them of the kind of experience they need to judge the actions and the designs of men in order to know ambition under every guise that it may assume, because these are the people who are going to choose the people who will make the decisions. That's very important. The people are the safest depositories of their own rights, of their own freedom, because they choose the people. And I'm going back to the quote we looked at the other day by James Madison, which said the same thing. I don't choose to believe that Madison said that elected representatives are automatically going to do the bad things. Some of them will do the good things. But the key is not the ability of the people who are elected. The key is the ability of the people who elect them, the voters, the citizens, the nature of the education. So Jefferson's argument is we have to expose our young people during the first 3 years of universal education to study which is predominantly historical, because people have to be taught to recognize ambition when they see it. They have to be taught to beware and be careful of it and not support it and not fall for it. And in order to vote intelligently, they have to be able to know what to look for, because, he says, the people themselves are its only safe depositories. Government degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people, the people themselves are government's only safe depositories, and to render even them safe. In the first 3 years of education, when people are just learning to read and just learning what reading is all about, how are they going to make the kinds of sophisticated calls and decisions that this process seems to suggest that they must make? How are they going to do that? I keep thinking of it practically. And the only conclusion that I can come up with is clearly you can't educate people well enough in just 3 years to make these kinds of determinations. But you can alert them what to look for. You can sensitize them on what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, what's trustworthy and what's dangerous. In other words, you can program your young people into looking for certain things and certain characteristics and certain attributes in the people they support. In effect, what you can do is teach them to be good acolytes in a system which functions around them, but they don't necessarily have to understand the whole system. All they have to do is believe how important they are to it. You can do that in a few years of basic education. So it seems to me, this is my own conclusion on this, is that Jefferson's proposal seems to presuppose a general population that is incapable and woefully unprepared for the kind of analytical depth and insight necessary to make meaningful assessments of candidates. Instead, I would argue, what Jefferson seems to be saying, it would not be possible to know these kinds of things with just the basic background that they have. So therefore, what we're talking about is a very scripted, controlled curriculum where people are taught not to think, but what to think. Are taught not what they should believe, but are taught, but are taught what they ought to believe. I would suggest that we're talking about a level of education, and Jefferson admits this, which is tailored to the circumstances and the condition of the students involved. We are not educating students to be leaders. We are educating students to be participants in a political process. And that's what education in a republic is all about. In 1786, 7 or 8 years after Jefferson writes this, Benjamin Russ, in his Mode of Education Proper in a Republic, talks about the kind of education which is going to produce little republican machines. And he talks about the fact that that education in a republic is unique because, by definition, a republic is a very unique kind of political process. But again, remember, it is a republic that has changed substantially as a result of the enlarged sphere that the Constitution has created. It is a republic which has transferred decision-making power from the electorate to the elected representative. So in a sense, Jefferson seems to be suggesting that if the potential candidate for election sends the proper signals to the citizenry, they will respond appropriately. And that is, to Jefferson, sowing the seeds of future order during the first 3 years of this education. And then, Jefferson's not finished yet. And then, in what is perhaps even more significant in this particular document, Jefferson goes on to explain, because I'm confronted with this question as you are, if the citizenry is only to be educated to the point that Jefferson talks about, how can we say that they are the safest depositories for the political system? How can we say that government's safest depository, safest place, is in the hands of these citizens when they don't know anything? I'm confronted by this. I'm confronted by Madison with the idea that the knowledge that people need to know in order to make this system work and all the rest of it, and that this is self-government. What are we talking about here? How is it possible that people with this degree of education can be trusted with literally the security of the political system? How can you rely on them? Madison says you don't rely on the quality of the people elected. You have to rely on the abilities of the people who choose the election, the candidates, who choose the representatives. Jefferson addresses this in one of the most unbelievable statements I've ever read. The influence over government, Jefferson says, must be shared among all the people. If every individual which composes their mass participates in the ultimate authority, the government will be safe. What Jefferson is saying is, in order for this system to work, we need mass participation, not just the ability of individuals to participate. We have to make sure that large numbers of people participate. And then he explains why. It doesn't matter who wins. as much as it matters that everybody participate. Because when everybody participates, you guarantee that the process is working and it can't be corrupted. It can't be bought by the highest bidder. Or that's private. Or, Jefferson said, public ones, public resources of wealth cannot be provided except by assessing levies on the people themselves, and that ain't going to happen. I personally believe, I mean, I'm offering my own opinions here, but I personally believe that Jefferson's formula is in deep trouble because of communication, because of the internet. I believe that it's popular now to educate the masses, to inflict on, to reach, to communicate with the people and the masses in ways that it wasn't possible to do then. I believe that what these people saw, what Jefferson and Madison saw as the security of the political system in the 18th century, is no longer operative. I think that Citizens United, the Supreme Court case decided in 2010 about the right of corporations and large unions to invest unlimited amounts of money into our political campaigns under the heading of speech, under the rubric of political speech, does indeed constitute buying the election and buying off the electorate, especially if we have small turnouts. I mean, there's no question that the smaller the turnout, the more corruptible this system is. And I think that's the point that Jefferson is making. But the irony is that what Jefferson is talking about here is not the intelligence, not the education, not the wisdom, not the insight of educated citizens that preserves the security of our system. It's their sheer numbers alone. Because there are so many of them, and because they are spread out all over the place, and because all of them have been told what to believe and what to look for, the system has become safe because the people are not corruptible, as long as you make sure that they turn out in large numbers. And for a long time, this did indeed provide the security and the stability of our political system. It is unclear in today's world whether that can long continue to happen. Because now with the internet and with Google and with the ability to blog and all the rest of it, we now have the ability to reach and influence people in ways that we never could before. It is very obvious that large amounts of money spent in communicating with voters whose level of education is not all that sophisticated to begin with is going to prove very, very difficult to deal with. So I think the security that Madison and Jefferson and the others had in the nature of Republican government by making the people the safest depositories of the political process itself is kind of up for grabs in today's world. I really believe that very, very firmly.
Dr. Bill?
Yes, Bob.
There's no technical problem, but I've been sitting here listening just rapt with what you've been discussing, especially concerning Jefferson's plan. And something struck me, and if I may, I'd like to ask a question.
Please do.
May we assume that Abraham Lincoln would have qualified as the rubbish which Jefferson planned to rake?
Yes. Given where he came from. Now, again, please remember that, Bob, that we didn't jump directly from the 1770s and 1780s to the 20th century or to the late 19th century. We went through the whole public school movement called the Common School Movement, the Horace Manns, and the whole idea of universal education as promoted in Massachusetts by Horace Mann and in New York by George Clinton and many of those people. In other words, there were very, very progressive, very, very positive reformers who began to see education as being the key to the American dream. And once we got that, what that did was create the whole contradiction between whether education ought to be something that can get us a job or whether it's something to create informed citizens in a republic. And we've constantly fought that battle ever since. But yeah, I think you're right. I think what these people assumed is that, you know, but my guess is that Abraham Lincoln would be one of the boys of best geniuses that would be raked from the rubbish.
And
yeah, I think that's a presumption here because of the ability he had. So the irony is that people's commitment and faith today in what we call meritocracy, Bob, is not that misplaced. I mean, Jefferson believed that this is a meritocracy. You are not excluding the lower classes from opportunity in America. What you're doing is cherry-picking talent. I know that in my years in higher education, one of the things I've been asked to do over the years in recruiting students is not to basically suggest in any way that everybody gets in if they apply. The basic idea was go out and get as many people as you can to apply, and we'll cherry pick the students we want.
And in a way, that's what the prestigious universities do to this day.
Exactly, except they have 50,000 applicants to deal with in a freshman class of 3,000. You know, they can reject 10 for every one that they admit, or something like that, because they're so prestigious that they're overwhelmed with applications. And then these people that are dismissed are required to go elsewhere for admission to college. And you know that students in high school who are applying for colleges, counselors tell them, you know, pick your priority schools and then pick your second choices and then pick your third choices and make sure you apply to one that if everything else falls through, you know you can get in. You know, I mean, that's what students are told to do.
Well, let me reconnect us real quick, as the gremlin is back. Let me reconnect us, and if you don't mind, one more question before you...
Oh, Bob, this is great. Please do.
All right, stand
by.
Let's
talk about this. Okay.
Dr. Bill O'Brien will be back momentarily. I wish to goodness I knew what was causing this problem. But at any rate, he will be here in a second. There he is.
Okay, I think we're back.
Yeah, we are, and we're in good shape. One more question regarding... Not the boys of best genius, not the ones who get raked from the rubbish. Well, maybe the ones who get raked from the rubbish, the ones who are going to get 3 years of primary education.
Right.
It sounds to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that Thomas Jefferson does not, he has no, and that's why I started thinking about Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson has no conception that those people who get 3 years of primary education, well, you know, maybe some of them will wind up being our primary teachers. But as for the rest of them, he only envisions them as being able to work a craft, do a trade, have some sort of a skill, and at best be able to do what his social and political betters instruct him to do.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so what we're talking about is a selective process whereby the brightest get the kind of education, Bob, that is going to make them leaders in this society. And the education that they get is going to be quite different than the education that the masses of people get. And I think, I mean, this is very, very uncomfortable when students are confronted with this today because, you know, for example, I see tremendous potential and turmoil coming with this movement that we hear now, these so-called MOOCs, these massive open online classes that are being offered by the most prestigious universities at no cost on the Internet. Where, I mean, the Harvards and the MITs and the Stanfords and the University of Chicago's and the Dukes and the Princetons and all of those folks who are participating in these online classes. And they're enrolling 10, 20, 30,000 students. And they don't carry credit.
And they're not going to get a ticket.
No, you're not going to get three credits from Harvard for completing a course in such and such. But they will give you a certificate saying that you successfully completed the class online. And you there's nothing to prevent you from taking that knowledge and going to an institution which offers the same class, and you should be able to sail in it because you've learned from the best.
Are you still there, Dr. Bill? Oh, dear.
before the next step is people are going to start demanding credit for these classes and saying, if I successfully completed and I demonstrated that I have the ability to demonstrate to not only complete this class but to master it, then therefore I ought to meet the standards for admission to Princeton or Harvard or Stanford or wherever else it is. I think we might be connected. The fact of the matter is that the process as envisioned by Jefferson and Benjamin Rush and the others is that these people, I mean, Madison went to Princeton and these people went to Harvard and they went to Yale and they went to Dartmouth and they went to Princeton and they went to Colgate and they went to Columbia and they went to the University of Pennsylvania, which was Franklin's institution. And they went overseas, and they traveled extensively, and their family took them. I think The Education of John Quincy Adams by John and Abigail Adams is a classic example of how you prepare your future leaders to lead. It's a level of education that everybody cannot get, and they believe everybody ought not to get because everybody's not capable of handling it. But John Quincy Adams, from the time he was 6 years old, was reared to be president of the United States. Was educated to be president. He was exposed to all the things he needed to know. He was at the court of St. James in London. He was in Paris. He was everywhere. And the assumption is he knew how international affairs worked. He knew how the world worked. He knew how trade worked. His mother, Abigail, was an incredible investor in securities. She was a really shrewd investor, much better than John. And so the result was that John Quincy was reared to lead.
Well, that was the next question I was going to ask, Dr. Bill. Is there any sort of documentary evidence of because Jefferson is very much a Southern planter, elite aristocrat type.
Right.
Is there any sort of documentary evidence of any kind of response from, say, New England? With regard to his rubbish raking?
Not directly a response to him, because it's obviously limited to Virginia then. But one of the things that becomes very interesting with independence, and especially with the movement to the Constitution, and the fact that these leaders from the different states begin to interact more than they ever have before. Many of them begin to move towards something called the creation of a national university. George Washington is very much in favor of this, as is Madison. What these people believe is that while you need an education system like Jefferson is laying out for the masses, for the citizens, you also need to have a special place where the leaders of this country go in order to know what a republic is and what it requires in terms of its leaders. And the idea is that it is absolutely vital in a popular government like ours, it is absolutely vital that leaders lead with the needs and the wants of the people that they represent in mind. In other words, they believe that a national university has to basically put substance to the kind of relationship between the leaders and the led, if you will. And so in a sense, you have a system of education for the masses that encourages them that the definition of the good citizen is to follow the leaders. And the education for the leaders is to give them the kinds of skills and the kinds of insights that are going to be necessary in order to make the big decisions and write the policies that this nation must function on.
May one creditably argue, then, that that's why the United States Military Academy gets established in 1802?
Yes. Alexander Hamilton is a big advocate of the Military Academy at West Point. And his argument is that this country became independent, and there was a massive opposition to the idea of a standing army in this country. And more than anybody else, Alexander Hamilton is instrumental in the creation of an army in the 1790s. And he uses the threat of Indians in the Northwest Territory, Ohio and Illinois and all those areas, in order to crush the Indian menace in the and open up the Northwest Territory to settlers and make land more readily available for incoming immigrants to the country. That basically his argument is that you've got to educate. If you're going to have a standing army, given people's fear of a standing army in this country, you got to have an institution that educates the military in the idea of what the requirements and what the rules are governing a military in a republic. And so his idea is that you have to educate your military in a very unique way as well, because this is a very unique political system. And so the defeat at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811, the final defeat of the Indians in the Northwest Territory, opens it up. But more than that, it also legitimizes the idea of a standing army in America, and the opposition to a standing military that the colonists had because of the British troops in Boston and the quartering of troops in private homes and all the other things that they worried so much about is overcome in the 90s, and that's Hamilton. And Abigail Adams is warning her husband John when he's president from 97 up until he leaves office in 1801 after the election of Jefferson. And Abigail is warning John to be very, very careful of Hamilton, because she says that he has delusions of being Caesar, because he's hung up on this idea of the military and the army and the glories of war, very much like T.R., I think. And she's very, very suspicious of him. And, of course, they almost manipulate the United States into going to war with France in Adams's administration. And Adams is able to pull the plug on that by sending a delegation over there and avoiding war with France. It costs John Adams re-election in 1800, guarantees the election to Jefferson. There's absolutely no question that the reason that John Adams appears in Kennedy's Profiles in Courage is because the general perception that Kennedy brought to the table was that John Adams put his own political career on hold in the interests of his country. It would have been much easier for him to go into the war with France that everybody wanted, especially his own party. And because we would have been at war, it would have been absolutely automatic that he would have been reelected, and Jefferson never would have been elected in 1800. So in a sense, Kennedy's book argues that John Adams is a hero because he put aside his own private ambitions for the best interests of his country. And he really did. I mean, you know, I have tremendous respect for John. I mean, if you read the way he educated his son, and all the rest of it, I mean, he really believed that family had something very special to bring to this nation. And he felt like it did. And, of course, if you look at the history of the Adams family, from John Adams to John Quincy Adams to Charles Francis Adams, and then at the end of the century to Henry Adams, you begin to see how this family has a history all of its own, all the way up into the 20th century in this country. It's a fabulous family. But that's the way, Bob, that's the way they saw leadership. And John Adams believed that certain people were born to lead. You had to find out who they are, and you had to cultivate them to do that. But the idea that you have a universal system of education, which meant that everybody had an equal chance, that everybody could become president, potentially become a leader of this country, was not something that these people envisioned at all. They felt that that would be suicide, that that would create chaos out of order, and was totally alien to the kind of world that they grew up in and the kind of world that they believed you had to preserve. And so, there's no question that our commitment to universal education through the 19th century basically contributes to changing that perception of a class-based society. Because what's bringing immigrants into this country during the Industrial Revolution is not only jobs, but the opportunities in America that theoretically that an education can bring you. And so it becomes almost vital that we begin to beef up and make education more rigorous in order to make it more possible for people to move from the masses into the governing class. In other words, the 1 out of 20 ain't going to do it anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not gonna work.
Well, Dr. Bill, I hope you don't mind my having interrupted these last few minutes of your program.
I don't. No, Bob, not at all. This is where I wanted to go anyway.
Well, we have the call quality is once again transmission quality is once again degraded. Shall we connect one more time and you just wrap
if you,
up?
If you'd like to, or if you'd rather just prepare for your program.
Well, let's just, I know you've got to get out and head to a meeting, but let's just reconnect one more time.
One more time.
And
okay.
And you can wrap up and remind folks to be here at the regular time tomorrow, 4 p.m., and, okay. And we'll go from there. Stand by a sec. And we will be back with Dr. Bill just momentarily. And
okay,
Dr. Bill,
reconnected, Bob.
I'll hand it back to you, and
okay.
You have a
Thank
good
you.
Meeting, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Bob. You too. And again, we will be back together again tomorrow at our regular time, which is 4 to 6. Today is special. I have a board meeting to chair at 5:30, so I have to go and chair the board at the local hospital here. But that only meets one Monday a month, the third Monday of every month. So one Monday out of every four, we'll have to change our time a little bit. Because I don't really want to get, I'd rather not give up that chairmanship at least for a while. I really, you know, it's kind of a passion of mine. I absolutely love this place. We will be back tomorrow. And what I'd like to do tomorrow is kind of revisit and rehash some of this stuff over and give people an opportunity to call and use the number to call and offer their, do what Bob did, and participate like Bob. We really want to hear from you. And I've got a couple of additional things to add to the mix in terms of education. But I believe that what we've touched on today really needs to be brought together again and summarized, because in a sense the kind of education that we've seen today basically pretty well defines the anticipated or the expected or the most appropriate behavior of citizens in a republic as envisioned by the founders. Obviously, it's not something you're going to hear in Fox, and it's not something you're going to hear in MSNBC either, probably, because most people don't know this stuff. And the purpose of our program is to basically make the general population more aware of these kinds of things so that they can begin to function as citizens in a republic like ours need to function. So with that, it is 59 minutes after the hour. Let me bid all of you a wonderful evening. I hope all of you are safe. Please be with us again tomorrow. We'll do it tomorrow, and we'll do it on Wednesday as well. Remember, our start time will be 4 o'clock, not 3. The Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and for the Head On Radio Network. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so much for listening. Please be safe.